Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and here we're a bevy of scientists today. Russ Chianelli is here from Travels, and then we've got three scientists who are all interested at the moment, anyway, in ozone. That's this famous molecule, which is O3, must be compared to oxygen, which is only O2, and that extra oxygen can do all sorts of interesting science. Ozone can be bad for the health for people who are down here, and it can be bad if we don't have enough up in the really high altitudes of the Earth because it stops a lot of ultraviolet radiation coming down to Earth. So who are the people we're going to be talking with? Dave Dubois, he's a professor of plant and environmental science at New Mexico State University. Gary Morris is also a professor of physics from St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas. And Mike D'Antonio from the physics department at NMSU also. So that's a lot of guests. Let's start with you, Dave, because I think that you're the sort of the leader at this particular project. Tell us, first of all, before you talk about the ozone project, what do you know about yourself? How did you become a plant and environmental scientist? What were those formulative years?
Well, it's been an interesting road, but I initially actually started out as wanting to be an artist. But then I soon decided that I'm more interested in technical things. So I studied engineering, and then I went to physics, actually. So I got...
Well, wait a minute. It wasn't that artists didn't make much money.
No, my mom was an artist. Ah. So I really enjoyed that
Mine,
you know, helping
too. I
her
grew
out.
Up exactly yeah. the same way.
Yeah. But once I got into school and I, you know, played around with, you know, physics and calculus, and said, oh, this is more fun than being an artist because you don't make a lot of money in art.
Where did you grow up?
Where did I grow up? Mm. I grew up in New Jersey.
You went into the engineering, you went into physics, and how did you become into this plant and environmental science?
Well, actually, I mean, I got real interested in the atmospheric part of the physics part, and I went back to school and learned about atmospheric science, and I got a job in New Mexico as a state climatologist, and I've been doing that for the past 7 years now. So I've been doing a lot of work.
You are the New Mexico state
climatologist.
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
And I get to do a lot of fun things, and one of the things is to work on projects like this that are very broad. And
let's move around the table. Gary Morris, professor of physics at Edwards. How did you become a professor of physics? What were those moments when you were a kid?
Well, I really got turned on and inspired by physics during high school. I had a senior faculty member who taught the class, and most of the other students didn't really like him very much, thought the class was way too hard. And I took it, and it just clicked for me. And so I kept studying physics right through college and graduate school. Ended up going to do research at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Washington, D.C., and that's where I got connected to the atmospheric physics and chemistry community, and I've been doing that work ever since.
Okay, and then the last guest we've got is Mike D'Antonio. What's your story?
Well, basically, I wanted to be a scientist back when I was in, like, third or fourth grade. I knew I was going to be in science. I told a history professor back in sixth grade that I wanted to be in astronomy, and he asked me what I meant by that, and I explained to him I wanted to learn about how the universe works, and he said, then you don't want to be an astronomer. You're going to just stare at stars all night. What you want to be is a physicist. So I thought it was interesting. A history teacher talked me into being a physicist, and ever since then, I wanted to be a physicist.
Good. Well, everybody, that's our guests today. Then we'll go back to Dave Dubois in plant and environmental science. Tell us about what's brought all you three disparate folks together. Why are you all here?
Well, we've been working with the El Paso MPO, who manages a lot of the transportation planning and all that, you know, the going-ons in El Paso in terms of growth and things like that with transportation. And one of the projects that they introduced us in was looking at air quality. And one of the issues here in El Paso has been ozone. And what we learn about ozone, a lot of it's from vehicles, the cars that we drive every day, including all the other on both sides of the border, because it's one big airshed. So we need to be able to understand what goes on here in El Paso and put it in context with the regional, you know, the broader Texas, and then find out how much ozone is coming in from other areas and how much is generated locally here in El Paso. And we really want to do that through actually taking observations, and that's why we're here to do a summer's worth of observations looking at the vertical profile of ozone.
I have a question. Why is ozone coming out of all these cars when there's a catalytic converter in every car?
Well, actually, ozone is not really coming out of the cars. It's actually created in the atmosphere. It's one of those pollutants that is not emitted through the tailpipe. Much of what comes out of the tailpipe is NO and NO2. and a lot of organics. And a lot of that combines with sunlight in the air, and that takes a little bit of time, and that makes ozone.
So it's bad chemistry.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Okay. And Gary, what's your contribution to this particular program?
Yeah, so I found out about this study last summer, and I had been launching balloons in Texas, started that program in 2004 in Houston to study ozone pollution there. Since that time, we've launched nearly 1,000 of these balloons from a variety of sites around Texas. And so when I found out about this project and their interest in getting the vertical profile of ozone, got connected to Dave. We had a little conference last summer and came up with a plan to incorporate these weather balloon launches into the study here in El Paso.
So your expertise is the balloon part.
Yes.
So you are going to interact with Dave and then send these balloons up vertically. And tell us what's in a balloon that allows you to get measurements.
Right. So we use a larger version of a standard weather balloon. We fill it with helium. It's about 6 foot in diameter at the surface. Attached to it is a small payload in about a 1 cubic foot styrofoam box. Weighs about 3 pounds. Inside that box is a little mechanical pump that was invented more than 50 years ago and is the standard technology for measuring ozone all around the world. The pump pulls in air from outside the box, and an electrochemical concentration cell reacts the ozone, creates a current that we measure that is directly proportional to the ozone concentration.
And then wirelessly sends that back to your base camp, wherever that would be.
That's right. So on the outside of the box is a standard meteorological radio sond, which measures pressure, temperature, humidity, and there's a GPS unit on board that tells us the latitude, longitude, altitude, and the wind speed and wind direction. And that radios the data back once per second to an antenna on the surface so we can see in real time what the atmosphere looks like.
So you've done Houston, Dallas, San Antonio. Once you've done one, have you done them all or not? I mean, tell us what the difference is from your point of view between those three distinct urban environments.
Yeah, Houston, we've done the most launches in Houston. That's a very interesting and I think unique environment. You have one of the world's largest petrochemical production sectors. You have a huge population that drives lots of cars, so lots of NOx sources around Houston. And you have this Gulf Coastal meteorology, which tends to take the air out to sea and then circulate it back into the city. And so you get extreme pollution events in Houston. It's almost the perfect environment to cook up ozone with lots of hydrocarbons, lots of NOx, and lots of sunlight.
What altitude do you find the most ozone, or is it simply maximizing close to the cars, if you like, around the people,
right,
and decreases on up, or what?
So the meteorology is an important player in this. The urban pollution is generally found in the lowest 1 or 1.5 kilometers. And as the balloon ascends and emerges from this urban pollution layer, you can see one of two things happen. The ozone can go down as you move into the next layer of the atmosphere, and that's an indication that the local pollution is the strongest contributor. Sometimes you see the ozone go up as you move out of that urban pollution layer, and that's an indication that you may have pollution coming from somewhere else that's interacting with your local sources. And only the balloons really can tell you this. These urban areas have lots of surface monitors, which let you know what the air is like that you're breathing. But those surface monitors can't really tell you anything about where that air came from.
Okay. Now, Dave, we'll come back to you for a moment. So you're new to balloons, but you're quite well familiar with the environmental concentrations of noxious materials in the atmosphere. What are you hoping to find in this particular El Paso area? Because here it's very windy. You know, most of the time it's windy. Even when they say it's calm, it's about 7 miles an hour, all going east. What are you going to learn?
Well, the measurements that we're taking this summer are a piece of a bigger problem. I mean, we're kind of putting little pieces together. So we're looking at the surface observations. Now, this gives us an opportunity to look at the vertical extent of ozone. And then we can combine that with models and satellite observations. So it's not just looking at one thing, but many things will give us a better picture of what goes on a larger scale and also at a smaller scale when we look at, say, a monitor here at the campus. There's a station here on campus that measures ozone and winds and meteorology, and we can put that in the context of what goes on. You know, where does the wind go? Because we have the Franklin Mountains, winds go around them. You've got temperature inversions, and you've got distance pollution sources, including wildfires and big urban areas upwind. So we put all of that together and kind of come up with a weight of evidence. What's going on with the ozone here? Where is it being generated? How much is it? So just as one piece of the
You know, there's another question puzzle. I have there along with Keith. If we have wind, mm-hmm. we're talking about bad chemistry, which is hydrocarbons plus NOx. Yeah. Well, if you have a lot of dust, hydrocarbonaceous dust, can't that absorb some of the molecules and change the output?
Well, that's an interesting proposal, but most of the time dust doesn't really have that big of an impact on ozone concentrations. It's mainly the exhausts and emissions from cars and the hydrocarbons. Those are the primary players, and then how they interact with the meteorology is the key component, and that's what we're trying to understand here.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, Dave Dubois from New Mexico State University Plant and Environmental Science Department, Gary Morris from St. Edward's University, Professor of Physics, and the hidden voice that you haven't heard yet, Mike DeAntonius from the Physics Department at New Mexico State. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. Since you're listening, we guess you're a fan of science and its exciting discoveries. Yet the challenges to scientific evidence have rarely been more ominous.
When Dave and I trained to be scientists, we were taught the scientific method, which tests a theory through experimentation. But before about 1600, nature was viewed as a product of something supernatural.
After 1600, people began to observe nature and develop hypotheses and experiments to test those ideas, leading to the scientific method.
Thinkers of the time questioned traditional authority and sought truth, which led to an explosion of scientific advances.
Yet today, there's growing anti-science sentiment with long-lasting effects. For example, in 1998, Andrew Wakefield published a paper linking the MMR, or measles vaccine, to autism. It got a lot of attention.
But he was exposed for taking money from lawyers suing the manufacturers of the vaccine and falsifying data. Yet people still believe his claims, and vaccination rates continue to fall, causing diseases to reemerge.
Other science deniers include the former South African president who refused to believe that HIV causes AIDS, and the Canadian administration led by Stephen Harper, who forbade talk about climate change.
America has its own climate change deniers and its political leaders, yet the start of the 21st century has been the hottest on record.
Regardless of politics and our personal beliefs, we need to push back against deniers of scientific evidence. We're accountable to one another, and future generations depend on us.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Dave Dubois, Gary Morris, Mike DeAntonio, and we're talking about ozone. We're talking specifically about what we're going to try to find in the El Paso airshed, which is a very complicated airshed, because you're only going to be looking at half of it, first of all. The balloons that you're projecting to send up there are going to be in El Paso, Texas, none from Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. And Mexico is the big elephant in the room for us. It's twice as big, twice as population. Why is it that you're just concentrating on this side of the border as opposed to doing it on both sides? Is that funding, or is that international law, or is it oversight?
No, we were we got to pick up a location. We're only just a few people at a time, and we are funding limited. It's always a funding limited. It'd be nice to have 5 or 6 locations all simultaneously.
Don't an occasional balloon get over there?
It could, yeah. If the winds are from the north, we could get a balloon that goes into.
But that hasn't happened yet.
Well, we're just going to get started on it right now. So,
would you remember when Wernher von Braun first came out here after the Second World War and started shooting rockets up? You know, every now and again, one sort of malfunctioned and landed in Mexico. That's a long time ago, but these things will happen. And balloons, you know, go where the wind takes you.
Yeah, we would love to have more observations.
How far do the balloons usually go? I guess that's a question for you, Gary.
It depends on the season and the wind speed.
Right.
We've had some come down within 5 miles. We've had some that go 100, 150 miles. So if it gets caught in the jet stream up in the upper troposphere, uh-huh. it can go a long way.
Oh, interesting. How are you going to do the experiments? I mean, what's the sort of logistics of this? Do you have a great team of people on the ground as well as people doing the day-to-day monitoring?
Well, yeah, we have how many universities now? We've got four or five. Four or five universities. We've got NMSU, we've got UTEP, St. Edward's,
Southwestern. Trinity.
They're all coming together here on the UTEP campus. We're training first, and then we're going to make sure everybody knows what they're doing.
So you mean you're training the students now?
Training
these
the
are
students,
undergraduates and graduates?
Graduate and undergraduate students.
Okay.
And most of them, this will be the first time seeing the instrumentation, let alone actually doing it. So they're going to be learning a lot.
And where will the sort of data be coming back to?
Yeah, we will post it on the World Wide Web. We have a project website. And we can make the link available to you to post online. Folks can go get the data. We process it immediately after the flight. We make graphs of the ozone concentrations, temperature, humidity. And then we also make a plot of the balloon trajectory. Since we have the GPS data, we can create a Google map to show the exact flight of the balloon.
Approximately how big is the team of students going to be?
There's probably, I don't know the exact number, but probably 10 or 12.
10 or 12.
In total, including some staff, too.
Okay. And so, Mike D'Antonio, I gather that's your role in this.
Yes.
Is specifically maintaining some form of discipline of focus with this team of students from five universities.
I am actually going to be trained along with the students during this week. It'll be the first time I've launched weather balloons, first time I've worked with the SONS and with the ozone measurement. And I'm going to be the one, hopefully, that's going to be out for all these launches, working with the students, making sure they're doing their jobs properly. I'll be the guy in charge, basically, making sure it all goes well.
We have some techniques here which look at the atmosphere and record the different concentrations. How does the balloon compare with the ground techniques?
Well, we always validate the balloon measurements against the nearby surface monitor. So that's one of our validation practices to make sure that they agree on the ground. We also validate the balloon measurements against satellites. And so after the flight is over, we can integrate the ozone concentration vertically and compare to the satellite observation. So we've got two ways to check our data.
How does the satellite observation tell you a depth profile of? How does it do that?
Yeah, mostly we use the column measurements from the satellites. So the satellites have very limited information about the profile of ozone, which is part of the reason the balloons are so important. Satellites are limited to two or three pieces of information in the troposphere, so their vertical resolution on ozone is very limited. The balloons are giving us about 100-meter resolution on ozone concentrations in the troposphere. But when we integrate the balloon measurements and get a column out of it, we can compare with the satellites to make sure that they agree.
And that's usually pretty accurate.
They're usually within 3 to 5%.
Except that the column isn't really a column. The column is sort of a diagonal because the balloons aren't going straight up, but the satellite surely is looking more or less, well, maybe I'm wrong, straight down.
NASA folks who produce the data adjust for the slant column that the satellite sees and make it correct it to be a vertical column. You're right that our balloon is going up also on a slant column and kind of a strange path. But as you get into the stratosphere, the variability in ozone is on a much larger horizontal scale than in the troposphere. So at the ground, you've got the most variability. You could look at a couple of different surface monitors here in El Paso and see one measuring 50 ppb and another one measuring 65 ppb. You could have these large gradients in ozone across the region, but the higher up you go in the atmosphere, the larger the horizontal scale of the features.
That brings up an interesting point, the accuracy of the number, all right? I mean, you see students using pieces of equipment and it will read out a number, and let's say an absorbance, and it'll say 1.389722232, because the damned instrument can do that, where it's only the first two digits that have any significance. So have you ever tested by turning two balloons at the same time, they should go more or less together. And do they give you replicable data?
Yes. So there have been many flights with multiple instruments on the same balloon, and they agree with one another to within 3 to 7% throughout the profile. There's some natural variability on scales of, well, at the surface, could be tens or hundreds of meters, and up at that level, kilometers. So you expect some differences between the instrument that are real. And so those differences that I mentioned at the surface are real differences depending on where the pollution plume sits.
So to follow up on Keith's point there, how long does it take a balloon to get up to its maximum? And isn't the Earth's rotation in that affect the column measurement and all that?
The Earth's rotation shouldn't affect the column measurement. The balloon goes up at 1,000 feet per minute. It takes about 90 minutes before it expands so much that the material finally pops.
Yeah, so in 90 minutes, the Earth has spun quite a bit.
Well, the balloon is following the air, so it's being carried along by the winds, and it goes where the winds take them.
What was the issue there about the rotation?
What were you trying to get at? I mean, when you were talking about a column, you were talking about a column from the satellite.
Yeah.
Okay, and in 90 minutes, or you know, the satellite can take a shot on the column, but something that's taking 90 minutes, the Earth is going to rotate.
That's correct, but it's also, everything is rotating. The entire fluid is rotating, so it's actually following the fluid as it goes.
Well,
there's other forces.
Down looking at the math sometime.
Okay, Mike D'Antonio, you've got the responsibility of all these students, right? Do you select them for a start?
No, actually, some of them I did select. Some of them are from my own department, and I asked for students who wanted to join, and we have two physics students from our department at Mexico State. Many of them come from Dave's group. They're more aware of the meteorology. My students are as clueless as I am of that. I have a little bit of understanding of meteorology. Dave and I have known each other for many years, and that's how I got pulled into the project. But, most of these students have very little understanding of what we're doing. And so it's good to have a leader that also has little understanding so I have the same questions they do. But at the same time, I've got the maturity to make sure that the things get done that we need to do.
So that hole that's up there in the stratosphere seems to be not quite as important as it was. We stopped using chlorofluorocarbons and, you know, society has changed the way it's operating, and that's an improvement. What's the real problem with ozone as far as the three of you are concerned? If you had to say in one quick, pithy minute why it's important to study the feature of ozone.
It's a health concern for many of us, including me, who have problems with our lungs, lung conditions. It can be really difficult to breathe on a day when there's a lot of ozone. And so that's one of the things that I have to watch out for, having a difficulty with my lungs. So it's good if we know as much information as possible about where that ozone is coming from so that we can either at least predict, if not mitigate some of this.
When you say where it's coming from, you mean not geographically so much, or do you? Or really why it is that we're getting higher concentrations beyond and above the bad chemistry that we were talking about?
I think it is sort of geographically. Most of it's coming from the upper atmosphere, and we're trying to figure out how it gets down to the lower regions.
Do we get local ozone warnings on the radio?
We do, yes.
Where do they get their information from, I wonder?
I think Dave can speak to that.
This is Dave. They get their information from the surface monitoring, and that's run by Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. They have monitors throughout the El Paso area.
So, Mike, you seem to know a bit about the health aspects, Mike D'Antonio. What are the reasons that we should be cognizant of ozone concentrations?
Well, again, we want to get an idea of what's happening and where the emissions are generating the ozone and how it's actually being trapped and moving within this area. And so it's one of those things that helps us to predict, mitigate, and respond to high levels of ozone in the area for people like myself who have health conditions.
So you yourself can tell when it's a bad ozone day because you...
Actually, I'm a pretty good predictor. Dave can tell you that. I've called him many times and said, how bad's the air condition, the condition of the air? And he said, very bad, and I guess you're having trouble. So it's one of those things that those of us who have lung conditions can actually tell.
You're the canary in the coal mine.
Absolutely.
What about the farmers and animals and so on, too? Is that affecting any of the products?
Well, this is Dave. Ozone does get high enough. There are impacts to biological organisms like plants, animals. It needs to be high enough, but there's a sort of a not like a threshold, but there's a certain level that impacts plants at all levels. But it doesn't really impact until it gets very high.
Well, what happens to the plant? They just don't grow to the correct size.
It affects the stomatal. Had the plants breathe?
Yeah.
Sometimes on some plants it actually closes the stomates underneath and then shuts it down, and it kills the leaves.
Do you do experiments like that in the laboratory?
I haven't personally. I study this stuff, so I know people who do that. Looking at greenhouses, and they bring in ozone and they look at what levels, if beans are impacted. So.
In fact, there's a neat NASA project that Jack Fishman started up. He's at St. Louis University right now, and we put an ozone garden on our campus. And you grow plants in the garden with two varieties, one that's ozone tolerant and the other that's just the normal variety. And they grow next to one another with the same sunlight, the same water. And you watch through the course of the ozone season, the sensitive plants sort of decay and don't do as well.
Wow, we've got to something very interesting at the very end. Let me just, are these genetically modified to become ozone susceptible?
So I'm not as familiar with the genesis of the species of plants.
But at least you know that there are experiments going on.
Correct.
Of that nature. On your roof in St. Edward's?
In our courtyard outside our building. And we get these seeds from U.S. Department of Agriculture. And NASA has a manual online for how to make your own ozone garden.
Well, that's one of the most interesting things we've got on this program. And if you just remember one thing, I'm now talking to you, the audience. That's one. Go online. It's a NASA site. Just put in ozone garden on Google and up will come the data.
Yeah.
How very interesting. And forget the results of this particular local project. Where will we go online to see the results as they come in?
Well, we're going to have a website at St. Edward's University. And then we will also have a place where people can go at our New Mexico Border Air Quality website.
Well, what is that?
It's nmborderair.nmsu.edu.
Okay. Well, if you can remember that, folks. Otherwise, just air quality, ozone, NMSU, UTEP, you'll find it one way or another.
Yeah.
Can I say one thing? If somebody finds a payload, if it's just landed, the box may still be humming, and that's the sound of the pump motor inside. It's not dangerous. Nothing inside is dangerous. Just put it in a dry, shaded location, and there's a phone number you can call. There's a $30 reward if we get them back. So nothing to be alarmed about.
And if it's humming, you can get $40 because you've had to do something a little extra. We've got to go. Let me just thank all of you. Dave Dubois from New Mexico State University, Plant and Environmental Science. Gary Morris from St. Edward's University in Austin, Professor of Physics. And Mike D'Antonio from the Physics Department of NMSU. It's been a rather complicated science studio. We've never done three before, have we?
No,
there's five of us, really.
Remember, really.
Right.
And thanks to Kimberly Garcia, our producer.
Okay, and we'll be back next week. And later on in the year, we'll give you all the results of this study. It won't be a 30-minute program. I don't know what we'll do, but we will be back with the data. And
Keith will give $100 to anybody that sneaks a monitor back into his...
Yeah, there you are. That's correct. Adios. Bye-bye. See you next week.